Welcome to another virtual interview on Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. I own Elaine's Literary Salon and Elaine's Restaurant with my wife, Cynthia. We've turned this into a literary hub in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm broadcasting from our library room on the second floor of the restaurant. So far, I believe I've interviewed 171 authors, including today. So I'm getting a little excited about this. This is our regular virtual interview for authors who can't make it down to the restaurant. Today, I'm reaching out to New York to interview Emil Buckman. Emil was born in a galaxy far, far away, also known as Baku, Azerbaijan, and he came to the United States in the early 1990s. Currently, he lives in Brooklyn, New York with his beautiful wife and adorable Wheaton Terrier, Chloe. Emil's a practicing transactional lawyer, structuring and documenting complex debt instruments. But by his own admission, this is a boring part of his life. When he's not practicing law, Emil enjoys reading and watching classics, history, fantasy, and sci-fi. When he has nothing worthy to read or watch, he writes his own stories. So Emil, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So let's start. What, do you have a copy of your book with you?
Yeah, I actually have a copy of both of my books. Okay. Because the first one that I started with was written for a birthday. Oh, I don't think it really shows. It was written for a birthday of my granddaughter. So that was my first experiment. It was called The Incredible Adventures of Hannah in Judea. The book eventually won the Purple Dragonfly Award from Story Monsters. And it was written for middle grade audience, where I just simply took my granddaughter and threw her in the middle of a civil war in first century BC Judea. And then, you know, she was very instrumental to that civil war, connecting with Herod, Miriam, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, and all other people who she didn't know before the book, but now she does. And then this is the second book. I don't know if it shows, but it is The Redemption Postmortem. The idea came to me totally unexpectedly. I thought about it, and I decided to put pen to paper. And in 3 months, from soup to nuts, you know, I wrote a book. Then it was, of course, long process with editing and everything, but you know, was really enjoying writing, and sometimes I would realize that it's already dawn outside and I'm still writing. So
it was, you know, I love to hear that. I talk to so many writers who, because it's so difficult, right? To write well is very difficult. And so many writers, I think, get caught up in the marketing issues and trying to follow trends, or the difficulty itself in the writing. I mean, there's days as writers we all have that are terrible, right? Sometimes the story's not coming, sometimes the actual craft isn't coming, but to find joy in the actual writing and the actual storytelling, I think that's really critical. I think writers have to connect to that. So I'm so happy that you had that. Yeah. It was kind of throughout this, that intense 3 months. Did you have that? Did you have moments in there when you were a little concerned?
You know what? No, but what I did, I literally let the story take me where it would take me. To tell the truth, the idea of the book and the end result are very, very different. Because as I was writing, I would do quick research into the places, geography, the background, et cetera, and then a new twist would just come up and I would follow it. And here I am with a book. So yeah, probably there were days where I felt lazy, but otherwise it was a breezer.
You know, you were really smart. A lot of people, and I'm a big outliner, and a lesson people have to learn very early is that when your characters are trying to do something, let them do it. You know, when the book's trying to go in a direction, allow it to happen. Just because you preconceive something, it can be a real trap to try to stick to an outline. But let's back up a little bit. Why don't you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what's Redemption about?
So Redemption Postmortem is about a nameless soul, and the reason the soul is nameless, because that, of course, happened post-mortem, who was really snatched out of the oblivion by the department, the Heavenly Department of Justice, and was thrown into a so-called pilot program created specifically to weed out Satanists and idolaters throughout the earth. So I modeled my book really very much based on the government, right? So the angels, that's a government. That's heavenly offices. Demons are nothing else but a maintenance department, and the soul is a special operator, which you're much more familiar than I am in your books, a special operator who is sent on a mission to do what he's supposed to do. So his first mission was to disrupt the satanic ritual of the U.S. chapter of Order of Nine Angels. He did that, saved the girl, who was the intended sacrifice, and all of a sudden, he stumbled upon the excerpt from the book called Book of Remedies. Book of Remedies was written, at least that's how the legend goes, by Shem, the son of Noah, and then was lost to centuries and had all kinds of magic powers. So his second task was to find the book, and he was tracking the book all the way through Middle East, because he tried to follow the transition of the lost tribes of Israel through Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, going to all these pretty war-torn countries, and eventually he found what he needed, and then the story takes 180-degree turn, which I'm not going to disclose.
Yeah, let's not give up too much. I mean, it's a really cool idea. You mentioned how it ended differently than you'd originally conceived of it. Where did the germ of the idea come from? Was this something that you've been living with for a long time, or did something happen that made you think of it?
You see, I am a big fan of history and philosophy, to be precise, theology. And if you really look at this theology, the view of hell and heaven and afterlife, they're viewed very differently, and people interpret them somewhat differently from what I see is in real theosophical works. You see, hell is not necessarily a place where you get roasted on a slow burner. Hell is where you're actually being shown all the terrible things that you've done throughout your life, and then your soul actually judges you. And if your transgressions are something that you can survive, then you will eventually end up in heaven. If not, then you will be exterminated, not by some third force, but by the embarrassment of your own soul. So that was the first kind of the basic premise of the book.
Can I just ask you before you go on?
Yeah.
How did that the concept of like heaven and hell evolve? Isn't it a fairly recent sort of a description? You know, like, because what you're describing is different than a lot of people think of it, right? At what point in the last 2,000 years did it change?
Probably, but I base my views, a lot of my views come from Kabbalistic learning. And, heaven and hell are the concepts that misunderstood by people. Again, this is just the terminology. Even the word Gehinnom, translated from Hebrew, is nothing else but the Valley of Fires, which is basically the place outside of Jerusalem where they used to burn trash for the city. Somehow that became hell. And heaven is a place where you simply enjoy the closeness to the Creator. Also, it is very important that neither angels nor demons have any ability to do something that the Creator doesn't want them to do. There's always a Creator who controls everything. Sometimes, however, the Creator chooses to take a very hands-off approach. Why? Well, you have to ask the Creator. I don't know. But most likely because He wants us to grow. He wants us to understand the right and wrong, to make moral choices. And that is how the story developed. It's basically the angels are nothing else but just government bureaucrats who do what they're supposed to do. And demons are nothing else but just maintenance workers who go about and fix stuff in the creation. And they sometimes receive a maintenance call, in my book at least. And sometimes that maintenance call, I call it false maintenance call. So somehow humans over the past 6,000 years figured out how to call certain demons. And they deliver a false maintenance call, and the demon then shows up pretty pissed because he realizes that he was just called for no reason. And humans were trying to take advantage of that to actually not really a good result, because demons do not have the ability to change anything or to give anything in return. So that's the premise. That's the theological, theosophical premise of the book.
So when you're creating, I mean, so let's step back. So it's obviously it's fantasy, right? Yeah. It's a little supernatural. It's a little fantasy. It's action adventure. What is the primary genre that you're writing in here?
Well, it's hard to say. I would say it's probably somewhere on the junction of action adventure, because a lot of the story goes through a lot of action. In places like Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, a few scenes in the UK. But at the same time, the premise of the story is, I hate to call it paranormal. I would call it more philosophical, theosophical premise that people can buy or not buy, depending on what their views of heaven and hell are. But yeah, I would say it's a thriller. Action, adventure, mystery, thriller. And the other thing that what I've done, I'm a stickler for facts, especially historical facts. Most of the facts in the book, surprisingly, are the actual characters. Hopefully no one will take offense out of these characters. The actual characters who either existed or who exist now. Some of them may have issues with law, so hopefully they're not going to go after me. And the premise of the story, Book of Remedies, is mentioned in religious texts. And then the book potentially did travel through Middle East. That's a possibility. It is very possible that it ended up in the hands of Mandaeans, which is the proto-Christian sect. Who potentially may have expanded to Afghanistan. So when you read the book, it is action, adventure, thriller, and geographical thrust, historical adventure, I would say.
So it's interesting because, you know, it is a theo-philosophical premise, and you're writing historical, but also you're giving a version of it that people probably haven't heard, like even when you're talking about heaven and hell, right? You're talking to a portion of your readers will not have heard this phrase like this. So in a way you're even if it's real, it's almost like you still have to use some of the same techniques as a fantasy writer, right? Because you have to create the universe. Yeah, so when you're doing that, how much do you have to stick to the actual history, and how much leeway did you give yourself to be able to create like the rules of this universe for the reader?
I was very liberal with the rules. I was very strict when it came to actual history and names of the angels. Samael, Azazel, Uzzah, Ashmodai, these are all actual figures in the Judeo-Christian philosophy. They're written, they're mentioned in the Bible, they're mentioned in other books. So I was really trying to stick to the facts. And the adventure part, I've done an extensive research. The figures are very, very actual figures. That's post-U.S. Afghanistan under control of Taliban is probably very, very real. The tribal areas of Pakistan are fairly real, or at least I'm hoping that they are. I really stuck to my research, to the names, places, and all the accoutrements of that part of the woods.
See, I love these types of books that you can learn something from, you know, as well as having a fun adventure. And it's really interesting when you incorporate like theology and philosophy into them too, because people can look at it and I think be more open to it in a way they otherwise wouldn't. Your first book was children's literature, right?
Middle grade. But again, it was very, very historical. If you go through the book, I actually took I followed Josephus, the writings of Josephus, which is one of my favorite. I took the piece of the Judean Civil War between the warring factions of Hashmonaim dynasty, and I pretty much just simply placed my granddaughter there. Other than my granddaughter and few secondary characters, everybody else is who they were. Everybody knows Julius Caesar, everybody knows Mark Antony, everybody knows King Herod and Queen Mariamne and their nemesis, Prince Aristobulus. They existed. They all existed. So it was just literally, if you look at the book, and by the way, the same approach that I took with the second book. It is, everything is real. Everything is what the Bible and history tell us. So I just follow the same storyline, taking a few liberties with details to make it spicier and more exciting.
So I have a book where I have a 46 to 48 BC timeline in it, in the same region, right? So it's using some historical figures as well. How much of a responsibility do you feel when you're talking about somebody real? There's no legal responsibility, right? They're deceased. You're not going to get sued for defamation, right? You know. So, but how much of like a moral responsibility do you feel when you're incorporating real historical characters, but you're writing them into fiction, so you're creating dialogue. You know, you're creating scenes they may or may not have been involved in.
Well, there is of course a poetic license here, but otherwise, I try to stick to the writings of their contemporary historians, Josephus, Philo, and everybody else who actually knew, who saw these people and wrote about them, to the extent of the dialogue. Sometimes I tried to maintain the format that I saw in Josephus, although I only have a 17th century translation by Dr. Myers, so it's very hard to see what is real. Where Julius Caesar talks as he talked 2,000 years ago, and this is Dr. Myers translating Josephus from Latin version that he had. But yeah, I prefer to stick to the facts. You'd be surprised how many, well, you wouldn't be, but many people would be surprised how many blank spots in the history there are. And they can be easily filled in with whatever you want. That's where your poetic license is. You don't really need to change the canvas. The canvas is great.
You know, I think that goes back to like all writers when they're doing the what ifs, you know, when they're in their imagining fiction within reality. And you're right, when you go back in any historical period, there's so much we don't know. History gets lost so fast that I think there's a lot of canvas there for you to paint on.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same, by the way, with the paranormal, supernatural, even if you take a look at the biblical characters, angels, demons, whoever you have, they're described in a very, very generic terms. And when I approach that, of course, no one knows what exactly angels do or what exactly demons do. But I kind of imagined the federal government and angels operating pretty much as the secretaries of the U.S. cabinet, doing exactly what our cabinet members would be doing. Is it a poetic license? Of course. But at the same time, you know, since no one has any better idea, I think I can do that with impunity.
Oh, it's very clever. I would only hope that the angels and demons are more effective than the federal government, having worked in it for 20
years. Unfortunately not.
So this was your debut adult fiction. What were the differences in writing from going from middle grade into adult? And was there any transition period when you first started writing, or was it more your natural state?
It probably was more of my natural state, because when I wrote middle grade fiction, I had to stifle myself and restrain myself to make sure that everything is age appropriate. A few times my editors actually reminded me that I went overboard and I had to scale down some of the more graphic scenes. In the second book, I just let my imagination run as it is, without any restraints. I allowed myself to include a few erotic scenes. I try not to put any curses in the book, not so much because it's not appropriate, because I think it's just simply not the language that the books should contain. When it's absolutely necessary, yes, I would have curses, but otherwise I try to use the substitutes. So in that regard, you have much more leeway and much more fun with adult fiction.
So when you're looking at these various genres, they all have different tropes, they all have different reader expectations. Right. Did you do a lot of reading in these genres?
Oh, I read a lot. So reading is the fun part. Yes, I did a lot of reading over the years. I mean, I grew up reading classics because in the galaxy far, far away, as you said, there were no TV stations or PlayStations other than the state-run TV. So the books were the only place where I could let my imagination run wild. And that's how I grew up. I grew up reading a lot of books. Of course, the current fiction style changed dramatically from what was acceptable or not acceptable in the 19th or 18th or early 20th century. But at the same time, these storylines, the plots, the development, the twists and turns, they existed in classics just as they exist now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The delivery of story and the structure of story has remained the same for many thousands of years. Yeah. But what's popular at a given time? Like, I was just reading a book from the mid 90s, and it was a number one New York Times bestseller. It would never get published today. You know, just way too much backstory, too slow, the pacing and everything wouldn't work. So you really have to be up on yours reads like a contemporary book, though. So well done.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I would follow the my sort of gold standard, the books that were made into movies or series, because that is the speed of action that probably the readers would expect, and that is the kind of the trope that the readers would want. And I personally think that George Martin's Game of Thrones is probably the gold standard of how the story, not so much with points of view, there are too many storylines, and people often get lost with that, but in terms of the speed of the development, the action, how fast it goes, that's probably the gold standard of writing, at least from my point of view.
Yeah, no, I agree. In the fantasy genre, for sure, it's a really a spectacular work. So I'm interested about your debut experience. You know, so it's a it's your second book, but your debut for fiction. I believe you have your illustrator on Amazon listed as well. Is that that's for the cover design?
Yes. Unlike my middle grade book, I didn't have illustrations inside. For the middle, my middle grade book was illustrated by Laura Hollingsworth, who is the illustrator of the Keeper of the Lost Cities, and her style was more appropriate for the book, for the middle grade book, and it had a lot of inside illustrations. This one, yeah, I was focusing primarily on the cover, and I found this wonderful gentleman from South Africa, Vincent Sammy, who turns out to be very well known in the dark fantasy circles, and he was the one who put together a fantastic cover, at least from my perspective.
No, it's excellent. How much input did you have in the cover? Did you just give him like the blurb on the book and let him run with it, or did you give him specific?
Surprisingly, unlike the first book where I was very hands-on with this one, Vincent did such a great job that when I saw it, I sort of thought that's exactly what I wanted.
So tell us about that experience of receiving your books when you first open the box and get to hold that idea that's been bouncing around in your head for so long.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting, of course, to see in print all your thoughts and this sleepless nights, and all of a sudden, finally finding the expression on paper. It was absolutely great. I really enjoyed it. Then there was a period when I was giving it to all my friends, and everybody was also extremely excited, so that added to my excitement. I think now this part is done, and I am trying to impress the public and the reviewers. I got very good reviews from Kirkus and Forward Clarion, which was very, very pleasant, and I was very pleasantly surprised. The rest is the readers will be the judge and the jury.
Do you have any apprehension when a book comes out about having these, like, basically these daydreams, right, that you're putting into a book? Do you get nervous at all when you're having strangers read it around the world?
Not so much strangers, but when I read it, it's one of those moments I read it, they say, why did I say that? I could have done it much better. I could have done it much more exciting. This sounds really cheesy. And then I get 5-star reviews on Amazon, and I think maybe I should stop reading my own book.
Yeah.
Let the others judge it.
I don't know any writer who doesn't have that same feeling. Like, I never go back and reread my stuff, but if I have to see something from like years ago or even a year ago, I'll go back and I'll be like, oh my God, every time you write, by the time you finish a book, you're a better writer than you were when you started it, right? So you would always do something differently, but at least you pulled the trigger. Sometimes writers get into that trap of just rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, and a lot of times it'll lose its pacing, it'll lose its energy with too much of that. And so you really just got to get it out into the world at some point.
Exactly. Yes, at some point you got to say enough is enough. You had all your editors, you had all your consultants. So now it's time to let your voice speak to the public.
What is it you want readers to come away with when they read this book? Because you have so much theology and philosophy in it.
Well, I want the main purpose of the book is to understand that there is an absolute morality in the world. I know some people may not like the words God-given or creator-given morality, but there are absolute norms of morality that we all subscribe to. And no matter how many times we have to kind of deviate from that straight path, because, you know, life is not black and white, life has all colors of rainbow, the moral compass is still the same. And that was the idea with my character, who started, I wouldn't say a shady character, but a soul who would do everything to weasel its way in heaven. And at the end of the book, it is a person who would be making moral choices regardless of the consequences. So that is the main story, that is the main lesson of the book. There is an absolute morality, and we all follow it, and we have to follow it. And at the end of the day, that's the only winning strategy.
So if you have, you know, outside of like a Judeo-Christian ethic, right, outside of that, if you're looking at other cultures that have some very significant different other moral guidelines, let's say, how does that jive with a moral imperative, like a moral a God-given morality that's imposed on everyone else, when you do have other cultures that, you know, like maybe put the first daughter to death, or, you know, or whatever it is, gouge the eyes out of a child.
True, but I don't know what it was 3,000 years ago, but today Ten Commandments is a universal moral standard. Whether it's Judeo-Christian mentality or Muslim philosophy, Muslims are pretty much, very much espouse the same ethical rules. I'm not talking about deviations, there are plenty of that in the world, but mainstream Islam is also very, very ethical in its base. Unfortunately, I don't have the same knowledge of the Eastern religions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, but something tells me that the basic moral imperatives are probably the same along the world. I don't think that anywhere in the world anyone will tell you that killing is good, lying and cheating is good, and fornicating with your neighbor's wife is just fantastic. I think every culture, or at least as it exists in modern world, would frown upon all of that.
I would definitely love to talk about that, but that's a different discussion. So you grew up in Azerbaijan. Was Azerbaijani your first language?
No. Azerbaijan was extremely international, and my first language was Russian. I spoke Russian, and most of the people in Azerbaijan spoke Russian, especially since it was all part of the Soviet Empire, so Russian was mandatory. But otherwise, it was a very, very receiving place. By the way, it was a Muslim republic, and I have only good things to say about my former compatriots.
You mentioned reading a lot of the classics. Did you read a lot of the classic Russian literature growing up?
Well, you see, my father had an enormous collection of books, about 1,500 tomes, if I'm not mistaken. And my reading experience would be going shelf by shelf. I still picture certain books on their shelves and how I would read it. So, and since my father kind of assembled them by country, I would have a few Russian shelves, then it would be French shelves, it would be English shelves, it would be German shelves. So I have been exposed to pretty much all international classic. I'm a big fan of Leon Feuchtwanger. That's one of my favorite. I love French writers like Balzac and Mérimée, Dumas, of course. At the same time, I am, to some extent, a big fan of Dickens, although English literature is somewhat different from French and German in style. And of course, Russian, yes. The Russian classics were absolutely great. I don't think Russian classics will be that marketable today because they tend to spend a lot of time contemplating things, going into soul-searching exercises. I don't know how much patience the modern reader has for that, but otherwise, it's a great experience.
Well, so looking at like the classic Russian literature, and it's very philosophical. And you talk about the navel gazing. How much of that do you think, or even French, or from all this international literature that you read, how do you see like reflections of it in your writing now?
Of course, yeah. And I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, but I have, well, as in the words of Forward Clarion, a lot of tonal shifts, because while the action still goes, there were a number of places where my hero kind of steps out of the action and contemplates what he's doing. He notices certain things around him and he thinks about them. He thinks how these things fit into his moral perspective, into his goals. So yes, this tonal shift definitely influenced by the classics. So it's not just pure action. They're also contemplation, soul searching. I wouldn't say navel gazing, hopefully it's just more of a soul searching, but yeah, absolutely, it's all there. And thanks to classical readings.
How do you think, like in our culture today, in the United States, How much do you think people are, like, children are affected? Like you mentioned growing up, and that's your entertainment and you're reading and reading the classics. But with the, you know, everyone's got a phone in their hands now, right? It's like they're carrying a television around with them, essentially. How do you think that's affecting the way they think of story and maybe even just think in general?
Yes. The problem with all of this electronics is lack of attention. People are not capable of retaining as much as they were in the past centuries. Like in 10th to 11th centuries, philosophers were able to comment on any philosophical book drawing from memory on other books. I can assure you that no current student would be able to do anything like that without checking with the ChatGPT or Google. So that ability to analyze, that's probably is inhibited by the amount of electronics. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I don't know. I'm not an educator, but this is something that I definitely notice. And then the second thing, what I really don't like about mass culture is this focus on those superheroes. The reason why I have a problem with that is that people say, first of all, in order to achieve something, you have to be a superhero. But the reverse is also true. If I'm not a superhero, I don't need to bother. And that's what I tried to show with my first book, where I had a normal 12-year-old girl without any super abilities, just simply by being there, by understanding love, loyalty, friendship, she could achieve, well, according to my book, she could achieve much more than any Superman or Batman would ever achieve. And that is, I think, the lesson that may have been missed on modern people with all this dedication to superheroes. That is the problem that's being ingrained in the minds of people. If you're not a superhero, you can sit on sidelines, you don't care what's going on, because you simply don't matter. And that's wrong. You do matter. You can change the world. It is important. And that is, and I continue with that message in my second book. You don't need to be a superhero. Yeah, you can have some special abilities, but otherwise, it doesn't require superhuman skills. It requires faith, dedication, morality, and loyalty. That's what it takes.
Well, those are such great lessons. I have some of the same themes in my books too, where, you know, characters have agency, and it's about having courage and standing up and trying to and do the ethical choice. So I absolutely love that. Let me ask you, when you're creating your characters, like, you know, people, you have a lot of historical characters, obviously, but when you're creating, like, your protagonist, your own characters, what is your process like for the actual character, like, creation, like, you know, quirks and flaws, and how do you do that? How do you put that together?
Well, it's interesting. Again, you see, when we're talking about historical figures, then that's easy. Basically look at their descriptions. And when I come up with my main protagonist, it was a very blurry picture when I started. And this is where I just let the book take me, and it took shape as the book progressed. I didn't try to finesse anything. I had my basic principles, and I had my outline, of course. We all do outlines first. But otherwise, some of the choices that my hero made, that's probably... Well, I wouldn't say that the choices that he made independently of me, but I just always put myself in that position, and I'm trying to think, what choices would I have made? Would I be this... Would I act this way? Would I not act this way? Would I be scared? And even if I'm scared, would I still do that? Because that's the right thing to do, and I have to overcome my fear. And that's how the character actually took shape. Yes, I did, of course, cheat. since it's a soul and the body was given by the heavenly offices. Yes, my hero did have super combat skills, ability to speak multiple languages, depending on the mission, and a great intellect. But beyond that, it's all about how I would act in this situation, and that's how I would basically describe my character.
I mean, such a unique and kind of interesting situation. Like, characters generally have to have some kind of misbelief at the beginning of a story, which is later rectified, or they have some kind of internal flaw or internal conflict, which then affects the external thing that they're seeking. But when you're talking about a soul.
But that's exactly what I have. My character, first of all, the beauty of a soul post-mortem is that we don't know who this character was. But based on the general description, he probably was not the best and most attractive human being. And at the beginning of the book, his only goal is to avoid the oblivion and weasel his way into heaven. Everything else doesn't matter. And then at some point, closer to the end, he finally decides to do something that is very important and very moral and important for the humanity, even at the expense of his own soul, which, by the way, is a much greater sacrifice, because we all, whether we're atheists or not, we all believe in afterlife. So sacrificing yourself for the better afterlife, that's probably not as grave of a choice when you're actually sacrificing not only yourself, but also your afterlife. So that is, the moral growth is there, Jeff, and it's absolutely, I trace that down in your books, I trace down everywhere. I just didn't want to focus on the flaws that may be the subject of sequels, where I actually finally get to reveal what the main hero was before he died. So that's again for sequels.
Oh, I love it. In your setting, I mean, this is an international thriller, right? So you talk about being in Afghanistan, all over. How much research did you have to do? And I know it's based on a lot of your reading, but how much as you were writing, did you have to stop and break to research, or did you just plow forward?
Yes, no. I would stop. I would do research. I would do a lot of traveling blogs, especially in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I tried to kind of, and again, it was great to actually see the travelers, the video stories by travelers, because you can actually get a feel of the place. You can see it. Plus, I've been traveling a lot. I haven't been to Pakistan or Afghanistan, but I have been to Bangladesh, so I do have some idea of how that part of the world may look like. Plus, again, extensive research would be extremely important.
Did you have any like research tools or research hacks that writers would find useful?
No, nothing. The normal research, going through Google, through the YouTube, it's actually, right now, research is so easy. You don't have to spend hours and hours in the library. But you do have to have some basic idea of what's going on in that part of the world, and the rest is just filling in the blanks.
So I want to talk a little bit about your process, because it's so different for all writers. Mm-hmm. Walk us through, the 3 months is incredibly fast, to write a book. Did you write every day?
Yes. And again, sometimes I would just, it was a bit of an addiction. Once I started, I couldn't stop. So no, first I put together an outline, and I did the research as I was outlining the book. Then I actually started writing, and then I just noticed many times that I deviate from outline. And then I would come to some place, and I would ask myself, okay, so what's going on there? What exactly is happening in that place? So I would stop writing. I would go back to research. I would go to Google, to YouTube. to traveling blocks to kind of get a feel for the place, for the location. And after that, I would go back to writing. And sometimes the places and the geography would turn the writing away from the outline into something completely different. Like, for example, when I described Landi Kotal, which is the main city in the tribal area in Pakistan, it's an incredible place. It's just so fascinating. There are more stores that sell guns than the stores that sell cellular phones. There's this famous steam-powered engine that takes tourists around the former British Raj. And, you know, all of that completely gives you completely new ideas. And then all of a sudden, you end up with some tweaks based on the locale. So, yes, I did have an outline. I did try to stick to it, but I also tried not to be a slave to my outline.
So how detailed was your outline when you start? Because I know like a Jeffrey Deaver does like a 90-page outline. Other people just have bullet points. Some people have nothing.
You know, given my corporate law background, I would start with a very, very high-level outline. I would start beefing it up. So eventually, yeah, 90 pages. I don't think it's 90 pages, but I would end up with a pretty detailed outline minus dialogue. Minus some of the action sequences. But yes, the outline was pretty detailed.
And how long would you write for? You mentioned some nights you would just keep going. Did you have like a word count or a page count or an hour count? Like how did you gauge how much you would write?
None of that. It was a really freestyle. I know I probably did all wrong. Professional writers do pace themselves. They do know the number of pages. They do have a certain number of words in mind. I did look at what is the normal for the modern day thrillers, what is the normal page count, but you know, I didn't really restrain myself. I would write and write and write and write, and then yes, I did have to cut some parts to make it a bit more digestible, but otherwise, no, I didn't have any guideposts. It was just enjoying. I was enjoying the story. That was the fun part.
You know, that is the most important part, for sure.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think it's also important for you to do what works for you, you know, and this works. And I wouldn't try to follow anybody else's process. I actually heard another best-selling author just the other day, and she was talking about how when she does a book, she knocks it out in a couple of months because she does what you did, you know, just fully all engaged. It's in her head all the time. She's staying up late at night writing. And so, you know, do what works. Like if you're producing, it's working.
Yes. Yeah. Well, let's hope. The jury is still out, but let's hope.
Well, you know, I mean, even in the end, right? Like how many copies of a book you sell or what kind of literary praise you get or whatever. There's so many factors outside of an author's control, you know, and so, I mean, I think you're finding joy in the writing and you're getting good books out and you're just, you know, I mean, I think that's it. And then anything that happens after that is sort of what happens.
You know, the process was a reward in and of itself. It was so enjoyable. I don't want to be too presumptuous, but I haven't seen any movies and I haven't read any books that would excite me the same way Redemption Postmortem excited me. So it was the plot, the twists and turns. That was exactly what I would have expected from something that I would have watched on TV or would have seen in the movies or read in the book. So the process was very rewarding itself.
Yeah, that's fantastic. As long as you're enjoying the writing, and honestly, if you're writing a story that's a story you want to read, other people, many, many millions of other people will also be entertained by it. I think that's really, really important. Write something that excites you.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time and a chore and nothing else.
So When you're writing this, are you writing in Word? Are you writing in notebooks? What are the tools you're using?
I'm so used to typing on the computer. I'm not even sure that I can handwrite these days. I completely forgot how to do it. And, you know, it's kind of hard to write. I'm so used to typing. So, no, I would work in Word just typing the words and even keeping formatting, because I'm so used to working with Word and with different formats, so it wasn't that hard.
And for editing, did you use any kind of editing software?
Well, no, nothing beyond a normal word processing, grammar and spelling. But then I just had a professional editor who's also a best-selling author, Nina Bruns. I enjoyed working with her. She probably writes a lot of stuff in your area. Mostly it's action adventures, a bit with the romance. So she was extremely instrumental. She was absolutely great. She gave me a lot of ideas, and she was very, very careful in doing the line editing. So that's I didn't use any AI software, if that's what you're asking. I don't trust AI.
Yeah, no, I mean, beyond AI, there's a lot of like editing that will give you, you know, reports on word frequency and overuse and that kind of thing. You know, basically like spell check in Word, only on steroids.
Yeah, probably. I haven't tried that. I trust human eyes. I trust human experience, and me working with Nina was fantastic.
Was she your first reader, or did you use any beta readers or anyone else before she saw it?
I did use beta readers, but it was after. First I cleaned up the book, and then I did beta reading through the website's called Hidden Gems. They did a beta reading for my first book, and they did a beta reading for my second book. I really wanted to be completely blind. I didn't want to just send to friends and family so that their judgment would be clouded. I wanted complete anonymity to get the true understanding.
Yeah, that's the key, right? With beta readers, you want criticism. You want to know where they stop reading, where things got boring, etc.
Absolutely, yes.
When you're writing, do you write in the same place every day? Do you write with music? What does that look like?
Well, no, I like when it's quiet, and I usually sit in my office at home. Working the writing at work is a bit too challenging because you get distracted by millions of phone calls, emails, and questions. So I prefer writing in my office at home, where I can just focus on what I'm doing in a very familiar setting, and I don't have any distracting factors. Because as I said, I live inside of my book. Any extraneous noise, including music, that would just detract of the process.
Because you were so efficient in getting this book out, I'm curious, like any tips that you can give writers for how to form writing habits. It feels as you're two books in, and it feels like you've kind of got this down now. What being able to write almost every day and to write and work a full time job. What were some of the pitfalls or the things you found that worked to help you stay productive?
It's hard for me to say, but you see, just given the nature of my work, I am used to burning midnight oil. This is not the first. This is not the first all-nighter. This is not the last all-nighter. That's what I do at work, and that's what I do here. In terms of the tips, I'm not so proficient in writing that I can give any tips. I would just simply tell people, look, let the story take you where it takes you. Don't worry about the typos. Don't worry about mistakes. Don't worry about repeating words. That's all will be cleaned up. Just stay the course. Keep writing. Once you're done, then there will be plenty of time to clean it up. There will be plenty of outside editors who will be happy to clean up your book. Just focus on the story. The story is the key.
Oh, that's great advice. And I think our writing styles are very similar. Our writing habits are very similar. So where should readers go to get your book?
My book is on Amazon. It's both in ebook format and in paper book format. Readers can also get it on Kindle Unlimited. It's free on Kindle Unlimited. And to the extent there's that people need more copies, it's also on Ingram's Park. But that's probably for wholesalers mostly.
And do you have any appearances coming up? I'm not sure when this will air, but do you have? Are you doing some book signings?
No. You see, when I wrote the book, I didn't know much about marketing. I'm still learning. So
join the club.
Yes, I thank you for this interview. To tell the truth, yes, someone put together for me a marketing plan, but I have no idea what's going to be next. I haven't even studied that marketing plan because that's the boring part of the writing.
I can tell you, I've talked to, you know, hundreds of authors about this, and the one thing that when a book breaks out, it tends to be an influence maker, loves a book and breaks it out to their giant platform. And other than that, no one seems to really know. Like things, you know, going on podcasts, doing book signings, going to book clubs, you know, getting the word out there and having people recommend your book seems to be the way that it spreads. But it seems, from my experience, once an influencer or somebody that has a large audience can get it out to them, that's when a book breaks out. I mean, you know, publishers don't really know, agents, you know, they'll tell you, right? It's they just don't know what's going to take off.
Exactly. And, you know, also challenging today, the most popular category of books is romance. Mine is more of a paranormal thriller. There are some there is a love story. There are some erotic moments, but it's not a romance. Number one today bestseller is Alchemized, which is characterized as romantasy. Therefore, marketing. I'm still in a very nascent stages of the marketing process. I have to think it through. I have to clean up my website, which is not that great. It's emilbachman.com, but it still requires a lot of work. And generally, I've never been very active in social media, so. It's the learning curve is very, very steep at this point.
You know, it is for all authors, and it changes all the time. So the thing that works in marketing today doesn't work in 6 months, you know. So, you know, don't feel bad. We all go through that. So, Emil, this has been really fun. I wish you a lot of luck. Congratulations on it. I always ask people who are listening to this or viewing it to please go on Amazon and rate your book. Even if you don't leave a review, just leave a rating. So it really helps people discover a new writer.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I really appreciate having me, and it was great.
All right. Thank you so much.